For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder. In the last 3 decades, there have been over 62 mass shootings in the United States, almost half of them in the last 7 years alone. The FBI defines a mass shooting as one involving a single gunman killing 4 or more victims in a public place. The average age of the gunman is 35, though one was just 11 years old. They are all male, and almost all are white. In the mainstream media, these killers are seen as individuals, terrifying, but individuals nonetheless, their histories parsed for motive or signs of mental illness, and indeed most of them suffer from mental illness. Almost no one suggests that broader social factors are at work here. It might surprise you to learn that in the 8 days since Adam Lanza took the lives of 20 children and 6 adults in Newtown, Connecticut, 100 people have lost their lives to guns in the United States. Since 2001, over 270,000 people have been killed by guns here. Whatever the multiple causes of gun violence are, they include a social tolerance that has rendered it nearly invisible outside these frightening outbursts of mass murder. Patricia Williams is a legal scholar, author, and professor of law at Columbia University. A member of the California State Bar, she has worked as a consumer advocate in the office of the city attorney in Los Angeles. She pens a monthly column in The Nation magazine entitled Diary of a Mad Law Professor and is the author of several books, including The Alchemy of Race and Rights and Seeing a Colorblind Future, The Paradox of Race. Professor Williams, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
You wrote a column in The Nation back in September called Guns and Mental Illness, Tragedies in Waiting. And now we have the heartbreaking killings of 7 to 9 year olds in Sandy Hook Elementary School. What inspired your thinking in that article, prophetic or simply observant?
Well, what specifically inspired it was, of course, James Holmes's massacre in the theater in Aurora, Colorado. The on the tail end of the Jared Lee Loughner, on the tail end of the killing at the Sikh temple in Wisconsin, I think that my concern had to do with the degree to which you have a perfect storm of factors for destruction, a kind of warlike mentality that infuses much of our culture. A complete lack of any sense of commitment to the restriction on the availability of nothing less than machines of war, from grenade launchers to handguns. And finally, a tremendously sad public misunderstanding of the mental health, the availability of mental health treatment in this country, accompanied by a slashing of funds at the state level for treatment facilities, combined with a lack of insurance coverage for mental health. For those seeking help, it's very, very hard.
You wrote that the criminal justice system itself treats people with mental illness as criminals because it's misunderstood, as though they are rational actors with discernible motives instead of people who are desperately ill. What's the relationship between the criminal justice system and this phenomenon that we're seeing, in your view?
Well, I think that the criminal justice, many in the criminal justice system understand the degree to which mental illness is a huge problem, better than perhaps the population at large. And our criminal justice system has become a kind of warehouse for people who have been clearly, markedly acting out for perhaps years in some instances. But the inability to really intervene on the behalf of anybody who is an adult, the presumption of rationality is so very strong that even families who are observing more and more bizarre behavior, watching their loved one become a different person, the standard is that you have to be a danger to yourself or others. So that's a fairly high standard, and the danger to self or others is a trigger for the criminal justice system. That's when the police become involved rather than a mental health professional.
So what do you have to do to get into the mental health system if you're not voluntarily going there in this culture or in our society?
Again, it has to be a danger to yourself or others. depending upon insurance, depending upon the state and the state of one's own insurance, one's if one has health insurance at all, very few health insurance, even the Cadillac plans, cover mental health. If you are hospitalized, if you can convince a hospital to hold an adult against their will, again, the standard is a danger to oneself or others, which means the police have to deliver them there. They have to be committed. There has to be a sort of, they have to be sectioned, so to speak. And sometimes it involves a court procedure. Once in the mental hospital, generally there's a, it's very hard to get anybody to be confined for more than 7 days. And then they are released and have to be readmitted, even if the doctors themselves feel that they should be there for longer. And again, this is partly has to do with insurance and compensation, and partly to do, again, with the standard of danger to oneself or others. And so you have these very strange scenarios where somebody like Jared Lee Loughner, who was schizophrenic or is schizophrenic, being medicated for the purpose of understanding that he is undergoing a trial for murder, it's unclear whether or not when he mm-hmm. actually begins to serve his sentence, whether or not he'll continue on the medication that made him at least compliant enough to sit through the trial rather than hallucinating. Again, schizophrenia mm-hmm. is, you know, it depends upon, but there are at least treatment regimens that can control for many patients some degree of hallucination. It's not a regular part of, the idea that somebody is only going to be treated in order to become or to look rational enough to be able to tried for murder after the fact is part of the upside-downness, I think, of our system.
A less noted aspect of these mass killings is that they are not simply mass murders. Little is known about the killer in the Sandy Hook case, Adam Lanza, other than that he was a young white male. He had access to semi-automatic weapons, and he carried out a mass shooting in a public space. And he had no plans for escape. He killed himself. His crime was a murder-suicide, and that also is a crime carried out almost exclusively by males. And I'm wondering, since I assume that mental illness is distributed evenly throughout human populations, why are the perpetrators of mass killings overwhelmingly white men? Why aren't men of color, or women for that matter, mowing down people in shopping malls and schools? And I'm wondering if you could, if you see, what do you see in this question?
Well, I think that's a complicated one to answer, and I'm not sure that there is an easy answer. First of all, despite the increased frequency in our culture, the fact is that these are still rare, and in order to have a statistical database that is more reliable, I think you'd need to bring in another few factors. For example, what is the mental illness at stake in some of these mass shootings? There's quite a spectrum of mental illness, and one wouldn't want to generalize mm-hmm. about that. I think that it's true these are almost exclusively masculine acts. So it's clear that whatever one says about the mental illness at stake, there appears to be a gendered dimension. I am not a psychiatrist, so I don't know if that has to do with the greater aggressiveness of those who carry more testosterone in their systems, or whether or not it is an intersection with the culture, our culture in particular, which both arms people indiscriminately and gives a message that in order to express one's identity, one has to be an aggressor, one has to be a cowboy, one expresses rage in assertive, extremely assertive and violent ways. Alternatively, I think that there are some sociologists who might attribute it to the fact that there is a sense of constant hunkered down endangerment. Certainly one sees that even in our ordinary nonviolent political discourse, that we are a very divided country right now, but there is a hunkered down vocabulary in which people, you know, right after the election went out and bought more guns than, I think the volume of buying guns leapt by a multiple of 10 or 100, depending upon the state. So people are feeling what I would say is very clearly irrationally at war with one another. And that's a cultural phenomenon that we don't attribute to mental illness per se, but certainly I think if one adds in mental illness, I think the sense of what some sociologists have called aggrieved entitlement might be at work.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that. Actually, there was a piece in the New York Times on December 17th that was an opinion piece by a man named Adam Lankford. He's a criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama. And in addition to, he identifies three factors common to all mass shooters. One is that they're struggling with some form of mental illness and they want to die. The second factor, he says, is a deep sense of victimization and a belief that the killer's life has been ruined by someone else who has bullied, oppressed, or persecuted him. And he says, not surprisingly, the presence of mental illness can inflame these beliefs, leading perpetrators to have irrational and exaggerated perceptions of their own victimization. But what's interesting is, and he identifies a third factor, which he says is the desire to acquire fame and glory through killing. And interestingly, he attributes the same triad to a suicide bomber in another culture. He says it's a mistake to look at it as a religious phenomenon or a political phenomenon. But anyway, he says, this second category is what's interesting to me. You mentioned aggrieved entitlement. There's a sociologist named Michael Kimmel at SUNY Stony Brook, right?
He was the person to whom I was referring, yes.
Yes. And he sees it as a characteristic of males threatened by a perceived loss of privilege with respect to other groups. He says it's a gendered emotion, a fusing of that humiliating loss of manhood and the moral obligation and entitlement to get it back. I hadn't seen anything like this until this latest killing. But there's another guy, William Hanby, now he's a journalist, writing in The Examiner, extends the concept to race, going to what you said, Patricia Williams, going so far as to link what he calls the Republican meltdown in the 2012 election cycle as white men going mad at their loss of power and reaching for their guns. And David Sirota writes in Salon about how white privilege prevents looking at white men as a demographic subgroup and instead produces a focus on mental illness and on gun control. What do you make of this stuff?
Well, again, I wouldn't go so far as to say that it is that this is a specific part of, facet of white privilege per se. I do think that it is a moment of some self-perceived threat to men, and again, depending upon one's ideology. If there is a kind of deep belief that a man should always be powerful, that one should always be assertive, that one, and perhaps it has a racial overtone, that one should be racially superior, or one is an automatic inheritor of an American dream in which the streets are paved with gold, then economic downturn or a negative message in political terms might feed into that. But again, I don't want to necessarily racialize it, because there have been mass murderers I think the greater emphasis in this is a sense of victimization and privilege.
Yes.
So, for example, the Long Island shooter who killed, I believe, Carolyn McCarthy's representative of Carolyn McCarthy's husband was a black man, an immigrant from Jamaica, as I recall. It wasn't just about victimization. I believe he was schizophrenic. He heard voices. He thought that there were going to be 1,992 counts against him, as I recall, because it was the year 1992. He was tried as a rational individual, but in fact, the man was very, very mentally ill. So I think it's a little complex to say that that one expresses it in cultural terms, because our language reflects the culture. But I do think the sense of being aggrieved and the sense of privilege is central, and that expresses itself sometimes in race, sometimes in political ideology. Extremes of all of this, I should say. We are talking about extremes. The man who killed so many at Virginia Tech wasn't white, but I think that his sense of, the expression of his sense of entitlement is similar to the others. But again, if entitlement or privilege is fed by the culture to particular groups, some more than others, then one would expect to see that kind of disparity as well.
And then, of course, we have added to that the availability of automatic weapons.
And I
noted that the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C. actually released a study in the spring finding that, it was in April. They published a report analyzing 2009 data from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and they found that states with low gun ownership rates and strong gun laws, go figure, have the lowest rates of gun death. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts was first with the lowest number of per capita gun rates, the lowest gun ownership rates, and the strongest gun laws. We could compare also the United States to other countries.
Yes,
because, probably
quite
relevant.
Frankly, even what we call a low, or very strong gun laws are not that strong when one compares what goes on across, the Canadian border, for example. I mean, there have been, I think Michael Moore in his film did a comparison of the gun rates of death in a city like Detroit and, a few miles away across the border in Toronto. It's stunning. The same statistic is even lower in Europe. It is not that there are not people with mental illness. It's not that people aren't misdiagnosed. It's not that you don't have a culture of masculinity and of privilege and of aggrievement in many places around the world. But very few places, aside from war zones, have as many guns as we do here. And these
Colombia.
And these statistics reflect it. And I think much has been cited by perhaps the comparison that is handed up on a silver plate to us at this moment, which is the same day as Sandy Hook in China. A man went into a kindergarten class and I believe knifed almost 28 school children. There were no deaths in that. And it's certainly, again, a reflection of a certain kind of cultural expression of identity. There have been, I think, 10 attacks on kindergartners in China in the last 3 to 5 years, I think, in which at least 20 children, whole classrooms, have been attacked by knife-wielding men. And so, however culturally that intersects with mental illness, with mental illness, and I don't know enough about what what's going on there. It may be copycat. Certainly, the third factor that you listed earlier of fame and glory also has a component of copycat,
right.
The desire to be in the spotlight, and that's how it has been expressed in China. But the effect has been dramatically different. There have been very few deaths in those instances.
Well, if you have to use a knife or even a pistol that fires, four bullets at a time, you're not going to kill as many people.
Yeah. So it's really important to remember that this is not an American phenomenon. that the mental illness component of it is, as you said, it is about particular vectors of mental illness and cultural tolerance for violence. But what makes ours so exceptional in history is that we seem to be at war with ourselves for no good cause. There is, this is to some extent, in my opinion, a kind of mass hallucination that the big dark boogeyman is always going to be coming through the door, and we need to be armed to the teeth with assault weapons and grenade launchers.
What does that boogeyman look like?
Well, it's interesting. And here is where I sometimes hear the echo of racial fear, in particularly when it occurs in these mass shooting situations. It's always in some lovely suburb, and it's leafy, and as in Sandy Hook, as in all of these others, it shouldn't happen here. Well, we moved here because nothing ever happens here. This mm-hmm. is a perfect neighborhood. As though the boogeyman could never be living in these gated communities or in the leafy mainstream streets of upper-class Connecticut. But it is as though the fear is reserved for somebody on the other side of the pale. Studs Terkel some years ago did a book about race. I think it's just called Race, in which he discussed a young woman who described herself as having been molested repeatedly by an uncle. And she told her mother and she told her family, and they just turned the other way. But she remembers going into a department store one day, and there was a black man on the other side of the store. And both her mother and her aunts gathered around and said, "Oh, that black man is about to look at little June." And she, at that moment, said, "I knew that something was crazy here, that here I was telling them that I was being molested, that I was being harmed by my uncle." And they reserved their fear for a random person they saw on the other side of a department store. And that's what they were protecting me against. And I do wonder if that doesn't have elements of some of our sense of being embattled in this country, that we have criminalized whole populations over nonviolent, very minor offenses, particularly the drug war, and we seem to be completely unaware of the extent to which that drug war is highly, highly racialized. So on the one hand, we have elections in states that say, "Oh, we're going to completely decriminalize marijuana," for example. But on the other hand, in a city like New York or Chicago or Los Angeles, almost, I think it's 750,000 in New York, young black and Hispanic men have been stopped and arrested and for very, very small amounts of marijuana. And our prisons are filled with people largely who are addicted, which is another form of mental health problem.
I'm thinking that, referring to your earlier...
But they're minorities. They're not, yes. I mean, this is, it does not, so I think we have this great double standard, that's a greater threat than... Mm-hmm.
Than the young man who
I think we idealize people who are very smart in math, and again, one has to figure out what's going on with Adam Lanza, but the stereotypes that were explored in each one of these. I believe that they were in school, they were brilliant in some subject, they were, I believe the young Vietnamese man and the Virginia Tech shooting was a computer whiz, and there is, I think, a kind of stereotype that if you're smart, then you can be forgiven all kinds of strange behavior, and I think that the response to mental illness gets delayed. It's just because it's difficult to treat mental illness, but also because we do have such a strong sense of rational actors that, I cite in the piece I wrote for The Nation, a family whose son was both depressed and apparently ultimately was showing the signs of bipolar disorder, which is a very treatable condition if diagnosed and treated. But he wrote a note basically saying he wanted to kill himself. And one side of his family wrote that he needed to pray harder, and the other half told him that he needed to read Ayn Rand's Epistemology of Objectivism, because reason will get you through anything. And the idea that it is either going to happen by a miracle or by reason does not treat mental. We would not respond to cancer like that. And mental illness is an illness. It is a disease. Many, many forms of mental illness are very treatable. We need to distinguish among mental illnesses. There has been some talk of Adam Lanza having perhaps a personality disorder, which is harder to treat and not as susceptible to medication. Again, I am not a psychiatrist, but the question of how will and being beyond one's control intersect with each of these really does have to be part of a diagnostic picture that's much more complex than seems to be discussed in the popular media.
All right, it looks like we're out of time. Patricia Williams, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. I've been speaking with renowned legal scholar Patricia Williams, law professor at Columbia Law School, and author of a monthly column in The Nation magazine titled Diary of a Mad Law Professor, and also a book, several books actually, The Alchemy of Race and Rights among them, and Seeing a Colorblind Future, The Paradox of Race. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.